A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 82. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Last Train. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, The Last Train, a post-apocalyptic drama. We're back after the apocalypse again, looking at the plight of a group of survivors who have just been awakened to find that the world as they know it has been destroyed by an asteroid strike.
And this was a 1999 miniseries or serial that ran for 6 episodes on ITV. And it was, in fact, something that was a little different because the survivors we were following woke up well after things were destroyed, not right after things were destroyed, which was kind of interesting.
Yes, and it's also a slightly unusual format for ITV, perhaps. As you say, 6 episodes, about 50 minutes each, running just before the end of the century, Brian, which is probably significant as well.
Yes, I don't think ITV was doing all that much sci-fi around then, actually. There was not a whole lot at that time.
No, not a lot.
So the story begins with various people catching a train to go from London to Sheffield. And you see various people getting onto this one train car and talking a little bit as people on a train car would. And one of the passengers seems to be particularly anxious, and she's carrying like a strange-looking canister in her bag, which she's inspecting carefully, and she is nervous about, well, when are they going to get to Sheffield? They can't be late, and so on.
Yeah, she's very nervous and anxious. The other characters seem to be just on a routine train journey. And as the train is approaching Sheffield, it all goes horribly wrong because the train crashes in a tunnel. So there's a rather impressive train crash sequence with people being thrown around inside this train car. And the mysterious canister that we saw in the woman's bag goes off and seems to release some form of gas. And that seems to freeze all the passengers. They're all sort of frozen solid very rapidly by this gas.
It was a very dramatic sequence where you only see things from the inside of the train car, but you see it being quite violently bounced around in this crash and everyone on board reacting to it, and finally this canister going off and freezing everyone.
Yeah, quite an unpleasant scene in a way. And then the screen goes dark for a while, and then we see the inside of the tunnel and the inside of this train carriage as it appears to start to thaw, to defrost. And as it does so, we get sort of ice dripping from tables, and then the characters themselves are reawakened to find themselves in this wrecked train, in this wrecked tunnel. And they emerge from the tunnel to find that the world is apparently in ruins, and they seem to be the only survivors of some form of disaster.
It was interesting because when they awake, they don't realize that any time has passed. They sort of realize that they've been unconscious for a brief period of time, but as far as they know, it's maybe a matter of minutes, and they've just had a train crash and they're trying to get out. And it's only very gradually that they realize the extent of the situation.
Yes, because they're looking and expecting the emergency services to turn up and rescue them, but there's nobody there to rescue them. In fact, there seems to be nobody there at all as they wander out of this ruined tunnel. So we should talk about the characters. There's quite a number of them. In fact, I think there will be 10 main survivors from this train carriage, but a few of them we should mention as they have particularly large roles. There's the woman we've talked about already, Harriet, played by an actress called Nicola Walker, and she was the woman carrying the mysterious gas canister, and she was the one who was very nervous when getting on board the train, and she seemed to know something about the disaster that was approaching. And in fact, as we later learned, she was heading for a top secret bunker somewhere in Sheffield, and she was carrying this mysterious gas that froze the characters.
Yes, she is an interesting character, and she worked for the Ministry of Defense, and at first she was sort of very guarded about the information she knew. And when she finally did tell people, of course, the other passengers didn't believe her and thought that, well, this must be something just in the immediate area that's a problem. And it very gradually became clear to them that this was something big. And it was not just a small area that was affected.
Yeah. And she's some form of scientist who knows what's going on, but she's quite slow in giving up that information to the others, isn't she?
Yes. Interesting character. Not a likable character in many ways, but a very interesting character.
Yeah.
We also had Mick Sizer, played by Treva Etienne. And he was a professional criminal, sort of thief and confidence man, maybe like even bank robber type of character. Smooth talking, sort of man of action, uses weapons. And in this group, he was sort of a rebel who wanted to cut out and leave and go off on his own. But also in some ways, he was a leader and sort of took different turns, either trying to get away from this group or trying to lead this group or trying to assist this group. So it was something where he was someone who was much more of a loner, someone who wouldn't normally fit in with this type of sort of random group. And he was learning that he had to fit in with that and had to grow and change with that.
It was interesting what they did with him because, as you say, he wouldn't seem likely to become the leader of the group. But in a way, he does. And he has to, as you say, he has to grow and change and take on a role that he's not really particularly keen on, but he's quite good at. We've got other characters, and as you know, this is a character piece in a way, a bit of TV drama. They've all got their own issues. And the young woman, Ro, played by Zoe Telford, who is travelling to Sheffield to visit her parents, and we learn quite early on that she is pregnant, and that will be significant as the story develops, both because she's not terribly keen on being pregnant, and there was obviously some reason for her travelling to visit her parents, but her pregnancy itself will be a plot point as the show goes on.
Yes, for sure. Another interesting character was Austin, played by James Hazeldine, who we talked about in The Omega Factor. He was also in London's Burning, the series about the firefighters. He was an older sort of father figure type character who had some pretty good mechanical skills. He dealt with figuring things out with plumbing or structural problems on buildings sort of a number of times. So he was very practical, but also had his own issues and his own things that he was dealing with and struggling with.
But he's one of the more likable characters in this group, as you say. Some of them don't seem particularly likable, but he was a friendly, affable chap. And quite nice to see James Hazeldine again in another British Invaders show.
Yes, absolutely. This was some 20 years after The Omega Factor, so he's definitely playing a different type of character and an older character. It was interesting because he was a very empathetic type of character, but also had some issues that he was really struggling with as well.
And then one more to mention, we have Ian Hart, played by a very sort of recognisable British character actor called Christopher Fulford. And Ian Hart is a police detective, and sort of interestingly, in contrast with Mick Sizer, he sort of has a real struggle as well with his change in role, that he isn't the person in charge, and that he seems to be aware of some of Mick Sizer's past, and he has a sort of has to come to terms with the fact that this chap he knows to be a criminal has now become sort of the leader of the group, and he has to give up his police role in a way, which makes it difficult for him.
Yes, it was interesting. It was sort of a bit of a dogs and cats sleeping together kind of thing, that the criminal and the police officer had to put those roles aside and say, okay, we have to work together in this because we can't afford to be fighting against each other, the things that we knew, the roles that we had before, really make no difference now.
So they did some interesting character work, I suppose, with this quite large group of people. And as you say, that little sort of role reversal for criminal and detective was one of those nice little bits.
I think there was some character development for almost every character in this over the six episodes. And that was nice. That was something that I quite appreciated in this.
A rock 12 miles in diameter strikes the earth, and energy waves fan out over the surface, and they rock everything up like a carpet. We were 6,000 miles from the point of impact. And
point of impact? What?
Central Zambia. Most of Africa's gone. Huge tidal surges would have been created in the Indian Ocean. Can you imagine?
What are you talking about?
So, talking about the production of the show itself.
Well, as we said, this was an ITV show, so ITV was looking specifically to do a big-budget drama serial. And they responded to the sort of trend of asteroid impact stories. Deep Impact and Armageddon were both in 98, and this was in 99. So they were looking to do something with a bit of an influence from those types of things.
And as we've said, the fact that the end of the century was approaching, the millennium was approaching, probably had a sort of influence on all these apocalyptic films and television programs that were coming out around that time.
There were lots of them around then, weren't there?
Exactly. The writer was Matthew Graham, who was originally looking to actually remake a television program from the 1970s called Survivors, which was a very well-known British science fiction show, which was created by Terry Nation, who created the Daleks for Doctor Who. But unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, depending on how you view it, they couldn't get hold of the rights for Survivors because the BBC still held the rights. And at that time, were in fact planning their own remake of Survivors themselves.
And if you're thinking, wasn't the Survivors a new show rather than an old show? The BBC did eventually remake Survivors, but that was about 10 years after The Last Train was done.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Which has been on our screens fairly recently.
That's right. So Matthew Graham, this writer, pitched this entirely new series to Granada TV, sort of with some of the elements of Survivors, but some new elements in there for sure as well. And they committed a budget of £4 million to this, which was their largest project for that year. That was a big budget for a British television serial. At that time, it was really a big deal for them.
Yes, they certainly went for it, didn't they?
Oh, they absolutely did. They actually gave it the working title of Cruel Earth, which retained that title for the Canadian broadcast. It was actually broadcast as Cruel Earth in Canada, and possibly in the States at some point as well, I'm not sure. But it was The Last Train in the UK.
And Matthew Graham, the writer, he was mainly known at that time for his work on EastEnders, and a show that was quite successful in the 90s called This Life, which was directed by Joe Ahern, who went on to create the vampire show that's not a vampire show, Ultraviolet, which you discussed recently, Brian.
That's right.
But after this show, he'd perhaps go on to be better known for helping co-create the time travel cop show Life on Mars. And he's also had another series on more recently, but which was perhaps less successful, called Bone Kickers, a sort of archaeology detective show. And he's also written for the new Doctor Who. He wrote the Fear Her episode for the 10th Doctor, which was on our screens a couple of years ago as well. They took the production on location, and they had to shoot in a disused railway station, obviously, which they found in Manchester, the Manchester Mayfield Railway Station. And then they'd go to various locations in and around Derbyshire. In typical British science fiction TV form, they had to shoot in a lot of disused quarries, and there's quite a few shots that look vaguely familiar from other shows, Brian.
For sure.
And they also, for one particular episode, went to an abandoned holiday camp, which was actually in North Wales. But all of this sort of made to look as if they were in and around the Sheffield area or the north of England, anyway.
Yes, it was definitely heavily location-based. And they had a lot of very good locations in this. The disused railway station, I don't know what the state of it was when they found it, but it looked very good on screen. It really looked like a railway station that had not been touched in many years.
We have to say that the set dressing in this show is fantastic. I mean, the amount of rubble and litter they managed to find to put around their various sets and locations is quite remarkable. It makes you wonder who had to clear it all up afterwards, Brian.
Yes. Well, their creation of ruined England was very well done. They did some fairly extensive CGI work for the first episode, doing the ruined city of Sheffield, which was Sheffield was also used in Threads. We talked about that quite some time ago, but they did it here in a very different way and gave it quite an impressive look.
Yeah, British science fiction television has it in for Sheffield as a city, don't they, Brian?
Apparently so.
Because here it is, ruined again, and on our screens again, lying in ruins, and looking very effective with the CGI, and then, as we said, with the set dressing itself of all this sort of rubble and ruins. Very effective work.
Yes, it was visually very convincing.
We've got two directors for the six episodes. We've got Stuart Orme and Alex Pillay. I don't know if they've got other genre credits to their names, but they did some interesting work. And they, as I say, they must have overseen this incredibly large production with this big budget for a television show in the 90s.
I'm guessing the two of them probably worked together a little bit as well, because it had a pretty consistent feel. I didn't get the sense of one director having one style and the other director having a different style, which you sometimes get. I didn't feel that here.
Right. No, it's difficult to tell which episodes, you know, are directed by a different director without looking. So yeah, they did a good job.
And they had music by Christopher Gunning, who wrote that haunting music and theme for Day of the Triffids in the early 1980s. So it was nice to see some of that coming back here and the connection to a different post-apocalyptic British sci-fi show.
Another little British Invaders connection, yes. Although I think actually I prefer his music for Day of the Triffids, which was very haunting and special.
Yes, especially for the theme music, I would say. But it was a very different style and a different objective in what he was trying to do. They just weren't trying to get that type of feel, so you end up with something very different on this one.
Yes, it is quite a different piece of music, as you'll hear in the clips that we'll play. So then after all this big production, it was broadcast with a fairly predictable and large amount of hype in April of 1999. ITV went to town trying to advertise and promote this series, and they actually broadcast the first two episodes over consecutive nights, which was quite unusual at the time, before then switching to a weekly broadcast for the remaining four episodes.
Do you know if it was successful on original broadcast?
I don't know what the ratings were. I remember there was a big, as I say, a lot of fuss about the first episode, which I suspect got a good audience, but it may have dropped off somewhat after that. It has been rebroadcast since on ITV2 in 2001, and it's been on the UK sci-fi digital channel since then. And it must, as you say, Brian, have had a Canadian and possibly an American broadcast as well.
Yes, I think so. I don't recall the Canadian broadcast, and I'm not sure which network would have done that broadcast, but apparently there was something.
It's quite strange in a way, because this was a show, as we say, with a large budget, which was promoted heavily, but seems to have sort of, after the first episode, disappeared from consciousness and perhaps not been the hit that ITV intended it to. And it's been rather forgotten since.
Yes, you do hear about it from time to time, but it isn't something that gets a lot of focus. And as we'll talk about in the next episode, is not that easy to get a hold of.
That's true, yes, we'll get to that. So next time, we're going to talk more about the actual disaster, about what's actually happened to the Earth to produce this disaster. Then we'll talk about the group themselves and their struggles to survive and their journey as they try to find a very strange place, the mythical Ark, which they have heard about.
And we will also talk about our own views and reviews and tell you a little bit more about how to find a copy of The Last Train. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you go to Facebook and search for British Invaders, you can find us there. So thank you for listening. This is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Do join us next time for the second part of The Last Train. This is Eamon from England saying goodbye.